an intellectual disability means you have deficits in intellectual functioning, in adaptive functioning. So these are kind of life skills like making friends or paying bills. And these kind of difficulties start in early development, so in the first few years of life. So that's a lifelong condition if you've got an intellectual disability. And about 3% of the population will have an intellectual disability. What my area of research is looking at is within this population, what are the rates of mental health illness and what are the types of treatments that are available, because we know that individuals with intellectual disabilities are more vulnerable to developing a mental health difficulty like depression or anxiety. So they're actually more vulnerable than you and I. But tragically and unfortunately, there's less access to treatments, less access to specialist services. So to kind of put it in perspective, there are some studies that show up to 50% of people with an intellectual disability will also have a mental health illness. And there are some studies that are showing only about 10% of people will access treatment.
And do we know if that's the stress of having the intellectual disability or if it's just something that is a coincidence? Do we know what the link is?
Yeah, there's a few different ideas and there's a few different kind of research studies kind of speaking to that. There could be a genetic component that makes you a bit more vulnerable. But I love what you're saying, that idea about, you know, if it's already quite stressful trying to understand and navigate the world around you, understanding social interactions, if, you know, certain kind of life experiences can be confusing, that can lead to feeling more anxious and more depressed. And there's also individuals with intellectual disability can be more vulnerable to experiencing really negative life circumstances that would lead to mental health issues like homelessness or abuse or neglect, so things like that. So there's a number of different kind of things that could contribute.
And how prepared are medical teams and doctors to respond to those mental health issues?
I think it varies. Some people have access to, you know, fantastic specialist training. However, I think it's probably not as widespread as we would like to see. And so it can be confusing. It can be stressful for everyone involved if, you know, if you have an intellectual disability and you're struggling to express yourself and make yourself understood and other people around you are not really sure what's going on. It can be very confusing, very overwhelming, and we find that sometimes people can bounce between services. So, you know, that's not a health issue, that's a disability issue. No, that's not a disability issue, that's a health issue. So I think a lot of those issues can come up.
So talking yep. about that bouncing between a disability and yep. a mental health issue, are there any tools we have to connect the two?
Yeah, so I think what's really important is increasing awareness. So increasing awareness for mental health practitioners, increasing awareness for families, for carers, that if they are working with an individual with an intellectual disability, that they can be more vulnerable to mental health difficulties. And I think in addition to awareness, what we really need to be doing is working more on improving treatments, so putting more funding into research in that area and then disseminating the results of that research so people are more aware of what effective treatments look like, how you implement them, you know, how you can go about that. So that's some of the stuff that my PhD students are looking at the moment. So we've just run a survey looking at mental health practitioners and counsellors across Australia and just trying to get a sense of how confident do they feel working with people with intellectual disabilities. And she found some interesting results. So in general, while a lot of kind of psychologists and counsellors in Australia feel confident to listen, to be empathic, to kind of have those general counselling skills, they don't feel very confident assessing or treating individuals with intellectual disabilities. And part of that can be not as much, I guess, specialist training, and also maybe lack of information about what treatments do work, and also lack of research about what treatments do work.
So you and the teams that you're working with are yep. looking at some anxiety treatment programs, if I'm correct. Yep. So what are some of those programs?
Yep. So we've done a lot of work looking at standard psychological therapies. So if you and I, you know, would have an anxiety disorder and go to see a psychologist, we would generally get something called CBT or cognitive behavior therapy. And it's a really effective evidence-based research that looks at how you think about things, how you act in situations, and how if you can do kind of important changes in how you think and act, you can help manage and reduce your anxiety. So it's about thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. So we know that's really effective for the typically developing population. We don't really know too much about how we can adapt that for people who have an intellectual disability. So that's exactly what my team has been looking at. We've done some work adapting that type of treatment for adults with intellectual disabilities who are having anxiety. And we found that it was quite effective. So we're publishing that at the moment and giving our recommendations to other practitioners on how they could do a similar thing. And my PhD student at the moment is focusing her kind of 3-year PhD on exactly that question, but with children and adolescents. So it's not necessarily about reinventing the wheel. We know a lot about effective treatments, but it's about how can we make it work best for children and adults who have an intellectual disability.
Do you have an example of how a question might change or a conversation with someone in that psychological space might change from the average person to someone with an intellectual disability?
Yeah, I've got to get my therapist voice on. So if I was working with an adult who didn't have an intellectual disability, in a way we'd be talking about quite a lot of abstract concepts, right? So we'd be talking about when you're in that situation, like when you're talking to somebody new, what thoughts are going through your head, what are the types of anxious thoughts you're having, how realistic are these thoughts, are you catastrophizing right now, what's the best case scenario, what's the worst case scenario. So it's a lot of, I guess, kind of discussion and dialogue around how realistic those thoughts, how helpful those thoughts are. And that's very helpful, but it's also quite abstract. So what we do with adults with intellectual disabilities is we take the kind of core concepts and reduce it to kind of quite straightforward, direct questions. And we use the metaphor of red versus green traffic light thoughts. So what I mean by that is instead of kind of talking about, is this a helpful thought, a realistic thought, I might say that, you know, a red traffic light thought is a thought that makes us feel anxious. It makes us feel stressed. It makes us stop. A green traffic light thought is a thought that's more helpful, it's more calming, it helps us kind of go ahead with our lives. So when you're in that situation, is this a red traffic light thought? Is this a green traffic light thought? So changing how we introduce things in a way that kind of makes more sense. But it's at the core of it is the same general idea that how you think about things is important. If you change that, you can change how you feel.
And then how does that change for kids and adolescents?
With kids, we're a lot more, I guess, interactive. We kind of bring in cartoon characters, superheroes. We do a lot of role play. You know, we're acting a lot of things out. We make it really interactive. We're looking at putting it on an online space, so being able to kind of increase accessibility across Australia and hopefully internationally. So I think what's important is that it's the same core idea. It's the core idea that we know that works in anxiety, but it's making it more age appropriate and more developmentally appropriate.
I think that online space is still a work in progress, but do you have any ideas what it would look like?
Yeah, so we were very lucky to get some grant funding from the James N. Kirby Foundation to support us in that area. What we're looking at is taking some of the key ideas from the treatment program that we've developed, so maybe say 3 or 4 key strategies, and really focusing on presenting it in a really kind of accessible, fun, interactive way so that children can practice it online, practice it with their teachers, practice it with their parents, and kind of really consolidate the work they would be doing face-to-face in treatment and being able to practice it outside. So that's one component of it. And also the accessibility component. So not everybody's going to be able to come in for, say, some of our trials and, go through the treatment, but we would still want them to access some of the findings that are coming out of it.